My dad always says that adversity is a terrible thing to waste. You can't control what life throws at you, but you can control how you react to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think anger is, in this day and age, an overlooked emotion, and the extent to which it can fuel your success has been lost a little bit.
Yeah, when I went to Don's house and I got lost driving around,
yeah,
I was almost overwhelmed by the open space. Because, you know, we live in LA, I mean, right in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And so there's not a lot of open space.
No.
And you forget how other people live, that it can be beautiful and open. And
well, that's what happened. We moved up to we have like 360 acres in the Hudson Valley.
Mm.
And we were living there for 3 years straight.
Wow. That's amazing.
And we started to, it didn't work long term because we're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, well, I don't want to live up there, but I miss a lot of what we had down here. Mm-hmm. And that's a place where you can kind
of
get
a little bit of both.
A little bit of both.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. Do you guys do like horses and stuff, or what do you guys do on the land? Like,
no.
Just go and spend time.
It's ATVs and
so
shotguns and.
Oh, that's so cool.
All the stuff, dogs.
You're gonna keep your place up there?
No, we'd probably sell everything if we did this. Yeah, I mean, this is like
the move. The
pipe yard 10 out of 100. Like, we would sell that place. We'd sell our apartment and move there and then find another second place eventually.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, my wife grew up on a farm in the mountains of North Carolina.
Oh.
With a creek that ran right through their house.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Is where they got their water. And she's been in LA for over 30 years. She's like, are we always gonna live in the city? And I remember telling her, well, we're not really in the city because we have two giant trees in our front yard.
and so she's like, your definition and mine are very different.
They really are different. But I think some of it is living in LA because of its cultural influence around the world.
Yeah.
I think if I was just choosing a place for quality of life, I would definitely not choose where I live. And I think there are different phases in life, right?
You know? Where would you go?
In the United States.
No, anywhere in the
No, world. Wait, hold on, wait. Do it both ways.
Yeah, sure.
Within the U.S. first.
Yeah, you know, I can't live anywhere I want, so I choose L.A., so I don't want to act powerless.
Yeah.
I don't know, because nothing has everything I want. You know, I mean, I love mountains, so who wouldn't want to be someplace like Aspen or Vail?
Yeah.
I love changing seasons, so Nashville and those kinds of places are really, really beautiful, but I also really like water.
Hmm.
You know, and so once you move to the middle of the United States, you lose oceans.
Well, so that's what, like, when I think about what our second place would be, this place has been our weekend place, whatever. Yeah. I don't think I would think of it that way. I think of it as a summer place and live there and then just and like go to Cape Cod or Maine for the summers or something like that.
Yeah. It's for a few years, we went and hung out in the Hamptons.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty beautiful spot.
I struggle. I had a place in the Hamptons for a little bit and I was like, this is like.
Yeah.
I'd be like going to the grocery store in the morning before I'd taken a shower and people were asking me for reservations. And I was like, no, this is not an escape.
Yeah. For you, that's not.
New York City.
That'd be uncomfortable. Yeah. That would be. It's like, second New York.
It's New York City just there, just like a bunch of traffic away.
I just want paddle tennis.
It is true. You kind of can't go like to your little coffee shop without it being like the, you know.
It's a little tricky.
Yeah.
I can't. Yeah. You can't go to any restaurant. You can't get coffee without somebody saying,
hey, I just want to tell you.
I don't want to interrupt, but they really do.
And I don't want to interrupt, and yet here we are.
Yeah, it is tough.
But it's, but you know, there's an upside to, I think there's an upside to any place you live. You just have to look for it and want it. And then eventually you start valuing the upside somewhere else a little bit more.
I think that is exactly the season I'm in life where I'm letting go of absolutes and I'm letting go of the idea of permanent choices.
I love that.
Which is like a very freeing because when you do what I've always done, you open a restaurant, you are there now for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
And I got my farm and I was like, my grandchildren will have this, you know? And I'm like, I'm just kind of over, like, I'm just like, my new thing is like, I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 15 years. I'm just going to do really good work on everything I do between now and then. And the world will kind of take me where it's meant to.
Yeah, we were talking about yesterday how if we had just five friends, you know, you don't need a whole bunch of them. You could live anywhere in the world and have a great time.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it really comes down to the people you meet and the relationships you develop.
The community you have around you.
Yeah. The community you have. And
you started with 20 friends.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to make sure we had enough for basketball. And, so
then you realize you could just find an opposing team.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Whenever there's five of us,
they don't need to be friends.
Oh, that's true.
It's better if they're not friends.
Yeah, who you're playing against. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
That's funny.
No.
But you didn't answer the question.
What?
Where would you live?
I actually did think about the fact that Franklin would be a beautiful place to live.
Interesting.
Yeah, I
have you been to Don's place, Donald?
I haven't.
No, when I went to Don's place,
I mean, the thing is, it's like,
He called me out and was like, you have to come here.
It would be like, it's an unfair way to experience Nashville because you're like, oh, yeah, obviously I want to live here.
I don't think I ever had that thought until I drove up to Donald Miller's house and I went, oh,
yeah, this.
Life could be like this. This is beautiful. This is.
And by the way, money goes a lot further there.
Nashville. Oh, Aaron's grown up in LA all of his life, so he doesn't understand the world economy.
No, of course I do. When I Zillow anywhere in Texas, and I'm like, I could get this 6 acres and a 5-bedroom, just like brand new house, but I'd still live in Texas. But you know, it is sad. We talked about that. I mean, that's the same as New York. You live in small places here when you're starting, and then
you gotta
build.
But that's the thing. Like even now we have a big apartment in New York. Like,
yeah.
And yet, it's still an apartment in New York. It's not like I don't know. It's like 3,000 square feet or something, which is big.
Well, Aaron's first place was 1,000 square feet.
Where here?
In L.A.
You know, I mean, yeah, they said 1,100, but I don't know where the 11 came from.
They were extending the measuring tape as far as it could go out the window before it. Like,
I think like the thing was like 1,100, and then the lot size was like 1,300 or 1,200. So like there was just no space. Yeah. Just a little. You really trash on my growth.
When Aaron lived in New York, I flew out to see him.
Yeah, this was fun.
And it was in Brooklyn.
I lived in a great neighborhood.
But it was in Brooklyn before it was Brooklyn.
It was like Williamsburg, but like third stop out. But 12 years
ago, a long
when
time
it was
ago.
Still, you know.
Before regentrification.
Like ex-mob families and like still, you
he's,
know.
He's paying his rent cash to the guy across the street.
Yeah, I paid at the gas station, which was really interesting. A guy named Mario. And he actually ended up, which the crazy thing is that during COVID, he ended up getting featured by the New York Times as like one of the best landlords in New York. Best landlord ever. I paid for $750.
I think I bought weed from that same guy at that same gas station in high school.
When I moved in, he said, hey, look, like, you know, the roommates I moved in with were like, the only thing is you got to go talk to Mario first. And I'm like, I don't understand. Am I live here or I don't? He's like, no, he has to approve you. I go to the back of the gas station. And he like, I give him the money and he's like, yeah, cool. Here's a receipt for $750 in gas. And don't go to the, you know, if you need, don't go to the police. Like, just call me. And I'm like, but why? And he's like, no, because the police will call me. And I help the police. We're all friends. And I'm like, okay. And he got my bike back a couple of times. So wild.
Dude, when someone says, if you go to the police, they'll call me, you're like.
Yeah, it made me nervous.
Okay.
But
he was so safe. You know? When you're protected by who you should be protected from, you're good. And
when you're protected by who you should be protected from, that's a great line.
So I go up into his apartment and I have to go up these little stairs into a closet. And that's where he lived.
It was a great house.
I just told him, I said, apartment. Don't let your mom come visit you. She'll just start crying.
I think he lasted about 3 minutes in that apartment and then walked right back out and said, just don't ever take your mother here. And I was like, no, mom would be proud. I was 21.
I love that. I was actually really proud of him.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think when you go through the gritty,
You really have to figure it out. Otherwise, if you held his hand through it all, he probably wouldn't be who he is.
No.
Yeah.
Well, he also, at the time, I was working in clothing, menswear. I worked up on 52nd Street And, you know, I did the subway back to Williamsburg every day, and it paid so poorly, this job, that I had to like bartend at night, but I didn't know how to bartend. So I took this job, this little bar in Lower East Side that my friend had like
built. What was it called?
It was called Lead Belly. Okay. Yeah. It was the Fat Radish was across from it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it was the same guys, and my friend had built the bar out. He's like, look, I can get you a job as a bartender. I'm like, bartender sounds so cool. And but I like barely ever drank, and that was like early in that season of life. And I go, and the first night they were supposed to be training me to bartend, there was like a Groupon. Do you remember Groupon?
Yeah.
There was a Groupon night. So there's just this like this cool little edgy bar, and there's like 50, 60, 70 like middle-aged women just trying to order Manhattans. And the bartender looked at me and was like, this night was the worst night ever for you to do this. And I ended up just washing dishes and you know, just running oysters up and down and just covered in, you know, fish. And it was great. Great experience.
Great experience.
He's like, don't ever tell your mom that either. Like, you're telling her you, like, you work at a restaurant. I was like, okay, great.
I do want you to know, I loved your book, Unreasonable Hospitality.
Thank you, man.
It was really, really wonderful. And I loved that on the audiobook, you added that little extra episode.
Thank you, man.
And because I just kept listening, because
I love that you got there. It's always so interesting to me who gets there and who
and
doesn't.
You know what's interesting?
I didn't get there.
Most
I was
of
so
time,
upset that he told me this last night.
Every time I finish an audiobook, the moment it's done, I just turn it off.
Huh?
And because I'm done, like, and when I finished your book, I didn't turn it off because I was still savoring the book.
Hmm.
And so I just let it run because. It was like enjoying a great meal. I like eating it slowly.
Well, thank you,
and
man.
And letting the taste stay in my mouth and just remembering it. And I was remembering your book, and all of a sudden you go, hey, this is Will if you're still here. And I'm like, what, Will? It's just you and me?
And it's like, hey, just now it's just the two of us.
It was just a little surreal going, and it's Will. I
mean, you know, so what was so funny about that? I wanted to just, like, the book is about surprise and delight, and so I thought mm-hmm. it'd just be fun to do a little bit of that at the end of the audiobook. And I sat down in the studio, and I did that because, you know, you record the whole thing, and
right.
you go back in a month later to do all the pickups, and
yeah.
we finished the pickups. I was like, all right, I want to do something all the way at the end, after the credits, just roll. I'm just going to riff for a little bit. And the guy's like, and I'll record it, but they're probably not going to include it. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, they just don't. Do that.
I know, they're so weird with the rules.
Yeah, and so I said, all right, press record. And I said, hey, whoever is listening to this mm-hmm. and making decisions on whether what I'm about to say gets included, this is important to me. My cell phone number is 917. If you want to have a debate, call me. If you don't call me, I'm just going to assume this is going to end up. And they never called me. So.
But that is one of your big lines. This is important to me.
Exactly.
That's your code phrase for
good memory.
It
dude.
Sounds like a request, but it is a command.
This is that there may be a question mark, but don't get carried away.
But it identifies as an exclamation point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's that really.
Yeah, but it identifies as. That's funny.
The reason that line really struck me is, one, I'm Latino, so I'm very non-directive. It drives my family crazy. I never...
No, non-directive is an understatement. It's what he's telling you to do is somewhere hidden in the statement. It's so confusing at times.
It's hidden in the request. It's hidden in the story.
You just need to find it.
You have to find it. And if you're paying attention, you'll realize there was a command in there somewhere.
So your entire life has been a series of Easter eggs.
I have actually found my niche is that I translate him to the world. So it works out so good. I just turn his ideas into practical, applicable things.
I may be the only parent where both my children growing up said, we don't want you to be Zen. We don't want you to be Yoda. We just want you to tell us what to do.
Just be very, very literal.
Yeah, be very direct. So when I heard you say, this is important to me, I thought, oh, what a great phrase. Because I've been married 40 years and my wife's Irish.
Hmm.
So they're much more animated as a culture, expressive. So when Kim was upset, I was never unclear.
It was always very obvious to you what was happening.
There was a definite, you know, vocal variation and
when
intensity.
When you were upset, it was a mystery to everyone around you?
Yeah, and so years into it, I remember saying to her, I don't feel like you're hearing me when I'm really angry. You seem to not care. And she said, when you're really angry, I don't believe you. Because there's not like heated emotional, you know, fuel behind it.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, so how can I, without taking on an approach to communication that I'm not comfortable with or don't enjoy, communicate the intensity of it? And I think that line is actually genius.
Oh, cool.
This is really important to me. So it's not I'm angry or upset or I'm, you know, this is just on the value scale. I'd really like for you to reflect your value for me.
Yeah.
By acting on this. And I think that's really powerful.
By applying value to this.
Yeah.
I think it's so, are you married? No.
No, no. Very single.
And this is really
very
important.
Single. Very single. And this is very, probably, my mother's like very conservative, right? She would, traditional values, you know, you need to come up the right way. At this point, I think she would just be happy if there were grandkids. Like, just please, please tell me there's something out there.
Like, I don't even need, I don't need to know who the mom is. Like,
just bring me a child and offer it to me as.
No backstory.
Yeah. She's.
How old are you?
I'm 35.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was 35. That's when my dad started like really saying, okay.
Like it's time.
Yeah, so
it's
you were 35 when you were not married.
Yeah. No, I got married. I did not have kids until I was 41.
See, perfect timing.
I think it's great timing.
I think it's great timing too. Yeah. But my dad, this guy, he lived in Boston.
Okay.
So very close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1 month before my first daughter, my first kid was born, he called me and told me he was moving to Florida. I was like, 10 years, you've been giving me a hard time. 10 years, and now you're leaving? No, what I was going to say about marriage is one of the, I think there's so many lessons that you learn in marriage that can be so appropriately applied to work, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like what I think is so interesting, and I'm kind of continuing on the conversation you were sharing that you had with your wife, is there, whether it's parenting or marriage, there are $100 million industries around how to be more intentional in pursuit of those relationships. Mm-hmm. And yet when it comes to being a boss or being a friend, the industries are hardly there at all. Mm-hmm. Right. But a lot of the same lessons apply. And so like in my marriage recently, just having conversations about very, very specific communication cues. Like, okay, when this happens, I am trying to pursue you, but like, can we identify the words? And which feels so counterintuitive and so inauthentic in one way, to like have to lean on a phrase to express an idea. And yet at the same time, if you actually care about the person, you're willing to do the work to figure out the exact right technique in order to meet one another in a place where you can actually communicate.
Yeah.
Not dissimilar to like, if you want to swing a baseball bat and hit home runs, there's a very specific way you do it, right? And so I found.
Yeah, what's your technique?
Well, no. I mean, it varies across the board.
Specific to each relationship.
I just think the technique is intention.
Yeah.
So like whether it's around travel and how you work travel, if you're not careful, you can be on the road all the time. And work travel, right? So all this is a thing, right?
Yeah, all the time.
And I'd imagine that you're, some of the time you travel for work is so fun. Right. And so energizing, and it's exactly where you want to be. And other times you travel for work, it's not for fun, right?
Yeah.
You're providing for your family and you're going to make money such that you can put food on the table, you know, to be trite. And if you're really intentionally pursuing your person, those are choices you make together. And yet there's a really fine line between saying, hey, should I do this or not? If you do it in one way, you're asking for permission.
Yeah.
If you do it in another way, you're asking to decide together. And it's not awesome to feel like you're asking for permission to do something you don't even really want to do. You're just doing it to support them. And so that's what I mean when I say intention is saying, okay, what are the words that I can use to make it clear that I'm not asking for permission on this. I'm asking for us to decide together. And if you say you don't think I should do it, that I don't think you are holding me back from doing something I want to do. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Can you resonate with this based on the way you looked at him when I said travel?
Oh, the road part.
Well, I mean, I traveled so much while they were growing up. And
even now.
Yeah, and now very I even still. But yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also being able to pick up the cues from your spouse, from your wife, and not ignoring her phrases of, this is really important to me.
Yes.
And because sometimes they're so nuanced that you can miss them, or you're so self-involved you miss them anyway. And it's,
or you're so stubborn that you want them to communicate it in a more obtuse way.
Yeah.
When then that's just selfish, right? Look, you know what they're saying, even if they haven't actually said it, just meet them where they are.
Yeah, no, it's always, to me, it's really beautiful when it almost happens magically, where I haven't said something, she just reads me so well. Or, she hasn't had to say anything. I could just feel that it was the right time, the right moment. Mm. I think in 40 years of marriage, there've been 4, maybe 5 times where Kim has said to me, please don't go.
Hmm.
The day of the trip. And each one of those times, I didn't go. I just canceled a major event and took whatever the damage was.
Yes.
And because of that, she almost never says it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because she realized if she says, please don't go, I will cancel everything.
And it can't be used flippantly because it will be received in the way it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I just decided right away in our marriage that she had the red button so that she would know she needed to use it really carefully.
Yes.
And because after the first time, she was like, oh, I didn't really mean it.
Wait, I didn't think that was going to work.
I didn't think you would cancel. And then I had to make the choice to cancel without resentment. You can't hold it against her.
Yes.
I believe in our marriage so much and value so much. The moment that you say to me, don't go, you're saying to me, I need you more than this needs you.
Yeah, it's not pursuit if you do it and then hold it against them.
Yeah, no. And that was a part of the process too, it's like never bringing it up. And we've had such a long, and the other day she said it, but she said it laughingly. And I said, are you saying you don't want me to go? She goes, no, I'm just playing with you. But what's funny on the flip side is we both had trips at the same time. I flew to Copenhagen to have fun. She flew to Malawi to build a school. and when we came back about 5 months later, one of our friends who went with us to Copenhagen said, did Erwin show you photographs?
And this is how bad your timeline is, but you have no sense.
Was it how many months ago?
It was 2 months ago.
2 months ago. I don't have any sense of chronology, by the way.
Okay.
I have yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and that's kind of it.
That's helpful context.
Those are loose terms.
I actually have a neurological condition where I don't have a sense of chronology.
Got it.
Interesting.
And so anyway, whenever that happened, and then
is that your way of saying don't make fun of me for it? Or
No. That's why I try to be very obscure. When I write a book, I actually have to have my team look at the dates.
Yes.
And so I can have factual accuracy all
understood.
The way through.
Yeah,
we flew to Copenhagen to eat at Noma for like one meal.
I think
you told me that.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was fun.
But our friend said, did he show you photographs? She goes, he never mentioned it. And then she came to me later and she said, you never mentioned going to Copenhagen. You never showed me photographs. You never talked about it. And I said, you just came back from Malawi. Like you suffered for 2 weeks, roughed it out.
Yeah.
We're building schools, building homes, helping people who were devastated by tsunamis. It just didn't feel like a really great time.
You're like, you want to see a picture of where they made celery root taste like,
they made like acorns?
Like beef tenderloin? Isn't this awesome?
I may not be the most emotionally intelligent human being, but I knew I should just ask about Malawi. And look at those photographs and not try to compare it to my experience. And I think sometimes when you're talking about relationships and you're traveling, when I would travel for work and it was really, really hard, I didn't want to come back complaining. And then when it was really, really wonderful, I almost felt guilty going, I was gone because it was so much fun. And so somebody, you have to give yourself permission. Kim would travel across the world to do humanitarian work. And I would tell her, you can't come back without taking some kind of 3-day vacation with your team. you need to go on a safari, you need to go see something beautiful. Yeah. And she would never give herself permission, but I told her, I want you to do that. She's taking so many short vacations without me over the years with the teams that she takes.
So she comes back revitalized.
Yeah, because I want to know, you have permission to enjoy life,
yeah,
even when I'm not with you.
Everything you're saying, everything we're talking about, mm-hmm, this is kind of my entire big part of what that book is imagine if we took 10% mm-hmm of the compassion, thoughtfulness, and intention we apply to that relationship and turned it and directed it towards the people we work with and those that we serve. Mm. It's like you, like just hearing you talk, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, if I do this, then I don't want to do this. And if I do this, I want to do this. And if she's doing this, I want to make sure she feels served in this way. Mm. Right? We're so, not everyone in every marriage, which is why so many fail, but people in successful marriages, they succeed because they work at them and they pursue those relationships.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about 11 Madison Park.
Okay.
It just seems like it'd be a good thing to talk
about. Just do this for the next hour.
No, honestly, I'd rather do this forever. This is good.
Well, and I know you've talked about it a lot, and that people have asked you probably a lot of the same questions over and over again, because it is an extraordinary story. So I hope you never get tired talking about it.
I appreciate that.
Are you tired talking about it?
No.
Good.
No, I think it's one of the, this is the thing about a book which has surprised me. Mm-hmm. I ran restaurants, 11 Madison for years, mm-hmm, and then a bunch more for the second half of my mm-hmm time owning that company. And you know, anything you do for work is a business, and in part you do it to make money, but if you love what you do it because there's something more meaningful about the impact you can have that kind of drives you. And mm-hmm I loved the number of people that I could impact in my dining rooms on a nightly basis, whether, again, the people on the teams or the people we were serving each night. Mm-hmm. Then you put out a book, and I had no sense this was coming, and mm-hmm that's me moving into your world. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's an exponential factor of mm-hmm people that you can kind of impact. And so, I mean, my life's work is the stuff I talk about in this book, and getting to talk about that is the coolest thing ever, because if you can even compel someone to see the world through a slightly different lens, even in the smallest of ways, that's extraordinarily mm-hmm gratifying.
Yeah. Just remember, Romeo and Juliet will never get old.
Yeah.
Because love stories are timeless.
Yes.
And your story of 11 Madison is a love story.
Mm.
And I think that's a part of what pulled me in. I felt like I was reading a romance. I wasn't reading a business book. It felt like there was this Romeo and Juliet relationship between you and not the restaurant, but the customer.
Mm.
And that the restaurant was the context for your love for people and creating unexpected experiences for people.
That's really cool. That's poetic. I've never heard it talked about like that. But yeah, it's accurate.
So could you go back to like day one?
Sure.
If you can remember that, you know, micro or that detailed, and talk to us like about the very beginning and maybe some of the emotions and some of the internal narrative that you're going through.
Well, I mean, when I first got there, so I'm going to back up even a little bit further. I wanted to be in restaurants my entire life. Mm-hmm. It's all I've ever wanted to do. Literally outside of one summer as a camp counselor at my high school summer camp, I've only ever worked in restaurants. Okay. It's the only thing I've ever done to make money. With intention. My dad was a restaurateur. I wanted to be a restaurateur. I wanted to be like my dad, full stop. My dad and I are extraordinarily close. I see in the two of you the kind of relationship that I have with him. But as I was coming up, and I talk about this in the book, I fell in love with restaurants because of fine dining. And then as I pursued a life in restaurants, I fell out of love with fine dining.
Mm-hmm.
But not out of love with restaurants. Mm. I fell out of love with fine dining because as like chefs became more and more like celebrities,
right,
I found that what I was passionate about, which was making the people in the dining room happy, to those chefs, it felt less and less and less important. And I would say I found myself like running around trying to prove to them that what I cared about mattered as much as what they cared about. And it culminated in this one moment in a restaurant. I was like, okay, this is, no, I don't want to do this. I want to be in restaurants, but I don't want to work with these egos anymore because they're, life's too short. I want to do things that bring me joy. And so I started pursuing other parts of the restaurant business. And when I went to 11 Madison Park, it's because Danny Meyer, who owned the restaurant then, asked me to go there because it was going through the beginning of the transition from a brasserie into a fine dining restaurant. And as the envelopes of excellence were being pushed, he wanted to make sure someone who fully understood and embodied and embraced his culture was there to push the envelope of hospitality alongside it, such that as the restaurant evolved, it didn't stop feeling like a Danny Meyer restaurant. And so the deal I made with him was, I'll take this job. I called my dad, asked him for his advice. He said, do you want to grow with that company? And I said, yeah, absolutely. And he said, then you need to be there for them when they need you if you expect them to one day be there for you when you need them. By the way, that's a message that I think a lot of people in certain generations need to understand. I think there's this expectation generationally where like people expect to be cared for by the company without understanding that it is a reciprocal relationship. And so I took the job with the caveat that I would work at 11 Madison Park for 1 year, and then at the end of that year, I would go run Shake Shack. That was the deal.
Dream come true.
And Danny accepted it.
Okay.
And so when I got to 11 Madison Park, it wasn't in pursuit of the passion that I ultimately started to feel. I was like, parachuted in. I had a mission. Get the train on the tracks. Get the culture straight. Get it feeling good. And so when I got there, it was more tactical. The restaurant was not working. There were two opposing factions. There were the people that had been there for a long time. And the restaurant was successful. It just wasn't critically. It was like the tomato meter. You know, the audience rating was high. Super high, but the critic rating was really low.
Why would you go here?
And so, which is a complicated place to be, right? Because if you work there, you're like, we're making people happy. But if you own it, you're like, well, we're not.
Like, none of my friends like this place.
Yeah, we're not doing it.
Right.
And so we had one faction that had been there for a long time and didn't want their cheese moved.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, and so they wanted nothing to change. And then on the other side, there were a bunch of people that had been brought in before me who had extensive, crazy experience, the most fine dining restaurants there were, who wanted to change everything. They didn't want to go along for the ride. They didn't want to bring them along for the ride. They wanted the change to happen to them. And so my early days there were to seek understanding of both, from both groups, such that I could get this group to slow down a little bit and get this group to speed up a little bit.
Were you able to keep both groups?
We kept a lot of people from both groups. We couldn't keep everyone from both groups. But what I found is people don't necessarily need to be agreed with. They just want to feel heard. And in the absence of communication between two opposing factions, neither group actually felt heard or seen or respected by the other. And so that was, if I go way back to the early days, it was that. It was like a mediator, which is a strange role for the person at the absolute top of the hierarchy to be playing, to be mediating tension between the two sides that exist within it.
You talked about being coming in with like this tactical kind of strategic mind. You were a tactician of culture and people. How did you navigate that? Did you draw a line in the sand and go, this is the new culture, either come with it or not? Or you talked about mediating. What does that look like at a place that has such a reputation and going, we're now, this is okay. We now want to go here.
So there was this, and I wasn't there for this, but there was this guy, Christopher Russell, who was the general manager of a restaurant called Union Square Cafe here in New York, one of the great New York restaurants, Danny Myers, who I think started there as a, a busboy and then was promoted to a server and then manager and AGM and ultimately became the general manager. And I always heard of the speech he did day one of being the general manager, where he stood up in front of the entire team and said, "Hey, I want to tell you my vision for this restaurant. This is where we're going. And I also want to make very, very clear that I will never, ever make a decision based on what's best for any of you. I'm always going to make decisions based on what's best for the restaurant as a whole. Because that's the only way I can actually take care of any of you, is by never catering specifically to any one of you." And I was inspired by that. And I loved the tenor of it. Not only how, until you actually unpack it, terrible it sounded, but how once you unpacked it, how brilliant it actually was. So many people can't take care of the whole because they spend an untenable amount of energy trying to take care of an individual. And by the way, you see that happening in companies across America right now, where they're so focused on one small group within their company that they end up alienating the entire balance of their company. And so I wanted to do that when I got there, but I also knew that he had the benefit of having come up in that restaurant and understood it well enough to have that talk. I couldn't say to the team, "This is where we're going," until I'd spent time investing in those relationships, just getting to know everyone, understanding everyone's respective positions and what they thought was great and what they thought wasn't great, recognizing that no one was entirely right. And then once I'd gathered enough kind of data points, then being able to say, "Okay, this is where we're actually at." And the reality was pretty simple. The people trying to move the restaurant forward needed to like really slow down and like actually understand that if we lost either faction, it didn't work, right? We were trying to push the envelopes of excellence and hospitality simultaneously. Those were our conflicting goals, and our success was going to come because of that tension, not in spite of it. I think it's this book by Roger Martin that talks about conflicting goals, which I think is brilliant. Like, to achieve anything of real significance, if there aren't those conflicting goals that create real tension, then like genuine innovation is pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
It's interesting. My, my daughter Mariah and her husband Jake, and she wanted to tell you that she and Jake are huge fans of you and they love the book.
Hi guys.
So she sent me two questions to make sure that she could be a part of the conversation.
Oh, sweet.
And she's, so funny. She's never done that with a single one of our interviews.
She's so uninterested in this book.
She never listens. She never listens to our podcast, but she will be listening to this episode.
Well, so welcome to your first episode of your family's podcast.
Yes.
And, but she said, "Unreasonable hospitality seems to have a value for kindness, but you also seem to be highly ambitious. And how do you reconcile the tension between ambition and kindness?" Because it seems that they can be in conflict with each other at times.
They, I mean, by the way, they're definitively in conflict. Really, truly. I mean, not inherently, but they can be.
Yeah.
And I say not inherently because I think it's an important distinction, right? There's plenty of, I mean, Gandhi was ambitious, right? Like, you can be extraordinarily ambitious in pursuit of kindness. But for me, where the tension like genuinely manifests is in between my knowledge and desire to create a culture where everyone feels empowered and like truly invited to the table to help us move our agenda forward. So to create a culture of empowerment and the fact that at the end of the day, I am a perfectionist. I have tons of OCD tendencies and I'm pretty controlling about what right looks like.
You just described my sister and
and you, yes.
I guess the question would be, you knew there's a set of issues, but you talk about like establishing an empowering culture, but really like what was the practical nature of going, how do you even identify two factions? How did you know there was a disconnect between what was happening in the room to what was going on in the back? Was that the mission set, or did you walk in going, I can feel the tension? And what does that look like in a practical nature?
First, just point of clarification, because I think it is important. The factions weren't the dining room and the kitchen. And I call that out because in many restaurants, that is perpetually the case. There's like an inherent tension between the people cooking the food and the people serving it. Here, there were people in either faction in either place. It was the people that had been there and the people that had just gotten there.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. It was the people who did not want the place that they had built and loved to change, and the people that were brought in to affect the change. So how did I identify that? Well, it was two things. First of all, literally just tons of conversations. You know, it's interesting. My buddy Simon Sinek, who published this book for me, was telling me, I think it's Cartier, when you're hired on as a new executive at Cartier, and I'm going to totally mess up the details here, but you're not allowed to speak in a meeting for something like 4 months.
Wow.
That your entire job is to listen.
Oh, interesting.
And that's hard for a lot of ambitious people, because you get in and you want to prove your worth, and so your instinct is to drop some brilliant bomb of knowledge and some idea of extraordinary change right away, when at the end of the day, if you were hired into the role, you need to have the confidence to know that you were brought in for a reason. And if you listen, it's actually more impressive than if you talk too much from the onset. And so it was about keeping my calendar as clear as possible, such that I could spend as much time with everyone. And when I say everyone, I mean managers, servers, busboys, food runners, and just filling my calendar constantly for the first few weeks, just to get to know people, to get to know them as professionals, as individuals, to try to understand what made them tick, to try to understand what their superpowers were. That's the first, is genuinely just tons of conversations. Keeping my calendar as free as possible, such that I could schedule time with as many people as possible. And when I say that, I'm not just talking about like managers. I'm saying managers, sous chefs, chefs, busboys, food runners, dishwashers, and everything in between, whether that's like scheduled meetings throughout the course of the day, or simply during family meal, which is when in a restaurant where the entire team sits down to eat together before service, where I'm not sitting with the managers. I'm just grabbing someone and saying, hey, eat with me. And the purpose of those meetings are to genuinely spend time getting to know the people, who they are as individuals, who they are professionally. What are their superpowers? Like, what are their hidden talents? Because eventually one day you're going to need to start to move people around into different positions, and until you know what they genuinely have to bring to the table, you're probably not able to like put people in the positions where they can thrive the most effectively. Side note on that, I see way too many organizations letting someone go because they aren't succeeding in their current role. Whereas if they had just gotten to know them a little bit, they'd understand that they would actually thrive in a different role. And then also to spend the time getting to know what we were doing, or what the restaurant was doing that they liked, and what it was doing that they didn't like, what their complaints were, all that stuff. And going into each one of those conversations with the very full understanding that everyone is speaking just through their own experience, and no one was going to be entirely right, and no one was going to be entirely wrong. Because I believe that once you do that with enough people on the team, then you actually have a very good sense of what's actually happening. And only when you really know what's actually happening can you figure out how to turn the ship towards where it's meant to be going. But the other beautiful part about spending that much time with people, listen, a leader is incapable of leading unless their people trust them. And I don't think it's possible to trust someone that you don't know and who hasn't spent the time showing that they're interested in knowing you. And so in these conversations, as I got to know them, they were also getting to know me, which set me up for much more success when it came time to actually take the wheel. Mm-hmm. So one, tons of conversations for the myriad of reasons I just tried to lay out. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, and I was blessed when I went into this role, that a couple of people that had worked for me for years before had gone over to the restaurant 5-6 months before me. I believe that if you lead a team and you don't have one or two or three or hopefully many more people on that team who trust you so implicitly that they will tell you everything and anything without fear of either recourse or that you'll betray their confidence when they do, you are losing out on one of the great hacks of leadership. Because if you have your people, they do a lot of that work for you. And I went in on day one and had already had drinks with all the people that had worked for me for a long time and already had a pretty clear sense of what was happening.
What did that look like? The report back?
From them or from the team?
From the guys that you had kind of sent ahead of you.
Oh, I mean,
was it pretty accurate?
Very accurate. More or less what I said about there's these two factions.
Yeah.
And they're not getting along. And we're not going to be able to do anything until we bring them together.
All right. So now you've assessed the situation. You've earned trust. You've heard and you've been heard. But you have to act. What was the first defining action you took as a leader?
Well, so then I had that big pre-meal, that big meeting with the entire team, to say this is where we're going. I think that a lot of people, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, how did you sell your team on your vision? And I think that's where people make some mistakes, is they try to sell the team on a vision instead of inviting them along on a journey and an invitation. There's most ambitious people are good salespeople, right? And when you're a good salesperson, it's a blessing and a curse, because what you can inadvertently do is sell people on an idea that they're not actually that excited about. They just fell for your sales pitch. And then you have people excited to join you on something, and then but they're really not, right? And so you've ended up with not the best team. Whereas if you extend an invitation, people can always RSVP and so it's a very subtle thing, but there's actually a material difference in how you approach something. And so it was, hey, this is where we're going. We are going to be the best restaurant in New York. And then two things, right? So we're going to be the best restaurant in New York. We're going to be very ambitious in our goal setting. So for the group that didn't want to change, they're like, ugh.
This sounds hard.
And we are going to be very patient in our pursuit. We're going to take this one step at a time. We're going to bring people along for the ride. We're not going to change everything all at once. We're going to do this incrementally, yet consistently over time. Which to the other group that wanted everything right away, they're like, ugh.
Did they end up being probably more frustrated?
I think both sides.
You're frustrated both sides equally.
Which, by the way, you know you've succeeded in navigating tension between two factions when both are a little bit excited and a little bit frustrated. Excited by the patience, frustrated by the pursuit, or frustrated, you know, by the patience and excited for the pursuit.
Did you ever have moments in that transitional process where you wondered if you were gonna get on the other side of it? Or did you just know you were gonna get there?
I mean, you have to keep in mind that I was 26 years old.
Wow.
When this was happening.
You didn't know.
So failure.
We're not gonna get there.
Right. Like, I think it's the, I always say to like people in their mid 20s, if you're considering being an entrepreneur, just frickin' do it, because you you always need to know your superpowers at various stages in your life. And what someone in their mid-20s lacks in experience, they overcome in just ignorant confidence. And ignorant confidence,
20s,
ignorant confidence is actually one of the greatest superpowers there is. Because, I mean, like, I have kids now, and like, I'm about to teach my daughter to ski. I just watched my buddy teach his kid to ski. And these kids are maniacs on the ski slope.
It's so discouraging watching like a four-year-old just bomb a mountain.
Because they've never, they don't know
no.
the ramifications of falling yet. And
or even their limitations, right? It's amazing.
The things that we can collectively accomplish when we have not experienced failure. I mean, it's pretty cool. Yeah. And I hate watching people waste that season in their lives.
All right. So this takes me to a different season in your life because I want to get inside of your brain.
Okay.
Because your mental constructs are really interesting to me. The way you think, the way you see the world, the assumptions you make when you make a statement. That confidence.
I'm like preparing for either the most like glowing praise or the most ravaging criticism. I'm not sure where it's going.
No, because even talking about being 26, having that ignorant confidence, it's like there's certain mental constructs that help people succeed. They don't even realize that they have in those moments. But when you came in 50th,
Yes.
And I've heard you describe this both in your book and in interviews that you came in last.
Yes.
And you say that with such certainty. I feel the word last when you say it. Yeah. We came in last. you talk about the, it feels like you're humiliated. It feels like you want to run out of the room, like you're standing there naked because you came in last.
Yes.
And I just, first of all, I want you to realize you did not come in last. You came in 50th.
In the world.
In the world of the best restaurants in the world. The guys who came in last were not there. and so I read that and I've listened to you and I've heard you say it. You did not come in last, but you believe that because I've heard you say it enough to where that is the way your brain is constructed.
Yes.
So talk to me about what makes you think that you came in last and how that shapes the way you get to first.
So I have a lot of things to say about this. I want to unpack this in a couple different ways. Amazing. Yes, this part of my perspective has been challenged in the past. In that room, we were last. And yes, it is very natural for me. That is how I responded. And I was humiliated. by the way, just as a quick aside, I did this thing, this book club with Simon Sinek. Like this thing. We filmed it for 2 days and they booked a space in Brooklyn and like me on camera going like for hours, right? What they didn't. And it was like they booked it through one of those websites like that they book spaces like Airbnb for studio space.
Yeah.
Didn't disclose that it was across the street from a fire station.
No.
And so like if you think this is frustrating, imagine being like 8 minutes through a 10-minute thing and you like it's on your third take and you've got it and then.
Well, we're really grateful to have this space right here in SoHo.
It's amazing.
And we're just living with the reality that we're in New York and we're going to have massive sound effects.
Yeah.
So that beeping was our planned sound effect for you feeling you are last out of 50. The 50 best in the world.
So, okay.
Yeah, walk us through it.
Have you seen The Last Dance with Michael Jordan?
Oh, yes.
Of course. Yeah. Yes.
So you know how he would always like pretend that if someone on the opposing team nudged into him that they did it on purpose.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he took it personally.
Then he took it personally just to give him something to get fired up about.
Right.
Yeah.
My dad always says that adversity is a terrible thing to waste. Mm. You can't control what life throws at you, but you can control how you react to it.
Mm-hmm.
I very naturally focused on being in last place. You're correct in your assessment. That did not require any intention. And yet there have been plenty of scenarios where in that same situation, even if I didn't naturally go there, I would have forced myself to go there just for the ways in which it would drive my competitive spirit.
Right.
I think anger is in this day and age an overlooked emotion and the extent to which it can fuel your success has been lost a little bit. We're in this season, this time, by the way, for good reason, where we're trying to focus on mental wellness and finding the silver lining and focusing on positivity, all of which is good. But if we skip over anger entirely, if we forget about the extraordinary power of being pissed off, then we're losing one of the things that just innately drives us as human beings.
I agree 100%.
So I feel like, A, adversity is a terrible thing to waste. That doesn't mean that we should just like jump and look for the things we can learn. I think we do need to give ourselves the ability to fully feel the weight of our disappointment for some measure of time and then move forward. But in the same way that with intention, I would have chosen to be angry, I'm also never going to be the person that says, well, like, Will, come on, have some perspective. You were one of the top 50 in the world. I'm going to seize on my instinct to feel frustrated because I believe that that is going to make me stronger. And by the way, I don't know that we ever would have become number one had we not debuted at number 50. Because I was so frustrated by that moment that it is the thing that caused me to, like, if we'd come in number 30, I would have felt we were on the right path. The reality is we weren't, because we were awesome, we were excellent, but we had not yet started pursuing a point of view, and coming in last was the thing that compelled me to dig deep enough to identify what that point of view needed to be.
Yeah, I just think it's such an interesting aspect of who you are. And I think if you had celebrated being 50th, you would have remained 50th, or that would have been the pinnacle of your story. But the fact that you made what other people would see as the ceiling, the basement. It was not the penthouse for you. It was the basement.
Yeah.
You'd been sent to the corner and you were punished.
Yes.
And it brought you back. I just think it's important because I think I'm told all the time, I need to celebrate small wins and things. I need to celebrate people's small wins. But a lot of times I feel like people want to celebrate something and make it feel like it's the consummate win.
Yeah.
And it's what I tell people when they're writers. When someone's writing, I can tell they're not going to finish a book when they have all their friends reading their first page.
Yeah.
And because they're experiencing the euphoric result of not actually finishing and not actually succeeding. And so they're getting the win feeling without the win.
They're having dessert before they've even like started their meal. It's like,
so when I read that in your book, I thought, I think this is an important mental framework that, in a sense, you are your own ceiling, and you decide what the ceiling is. And it could have been very easy for your whole team to say, come on, Will, we're in the room. Being in the room is the success.
Yes.
And you refuse to let that be the standard by which you would be measured, even though you could have rewritten the story and been successful.
Yeah, at that gone point. Home and made the team, everyone on the team feel great. Like, guys, we did it. Yeah. We've arrived. Like, which, yeah. By the way, my dad, I talk about this all the time. He gave me this paperweight when I was a kid. It said, what would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? And he's always challenged me at varying intervals over the course of my life and work to answer that question with like profound, radical honesty. And whatever the answer is, just try to do that. And he always says that most people won't do it for fear that if they say their most audacious goal out loud and then don't achieve it, they'll let themselves and those around them down. And so if you think about it like that, if you have the audacity to dream big enough to be number 50 in the world, why would you not be dreaming to become number one? Right? Like, does anyone ever grow up and say, oh, one day I want to win a bronze medal at the Olympics?
No.
Yeah. Why are everyone you aspires
up there? Right? I always wonder.
That's not to say, this to come off the wrong way, because that's an amazing achievement.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, no one grows up to be vice president.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I want to be the other guy.
Yeah.
Because by the way, like the last piece of that thing my dad always says is, and if you do have the confidence and conviction to dream your biggest goal out loud and don't achieve it, you will definitively have gotten a whole lot closer to that goal than had you never tried.
Yeah.
And so like, I guess what I'm saying is you'll never win the bronze medal if your goal is to win the bronze medal.
That's right.
You might win the bronze if your goal is to win the gold.
Yeah. So did you have people in your life saying, Will, enough is enough? or Will, come on, celebrate this, or Will, you're being too compulsive, or did everyone join you right away going, no, we need to be number one?
I have had people, or I had plenty of people over the course of that time, not telling me enough was enough as it pertained to becoming number one, but to the point of what we're saying before, of having people that were close enough to you on the team to like check you when you start to, kind of to your daughter's question, fall off the line that divides those two sides of who you are, say, you're getting out of control with this. So like, I'll give you an example. There were certain things that I wanted to do in the restaurant that were impossible because I knew the impact they were gonna have. And so like one day I went home for Christmas to my dad's house and we were opening presents. This is before I had kids. And so you actually still got presents. I was opening whatever he gave me and I found myself aware of how good it felt to rip wrapping paper off a gift. And I always like to keep my mind open to those little moments and then try to bring them back home with me. And so I was like, what if people could open presents during dinner? Like all we're trying to do is make people happy. This is giving me so much joy. And by the way, it's like ingrained in us from when we were kids.
This is so good.
And so from Thanksgiving to Christmas, that year forward, when you walked into the dining room, every table was covered in presents.
Wow.
And it was your first course. It was your caviar course. And in every box was a different component of caviar. And then once you opened a ball, we'd bring the perfect, like hot, fresh blinis to the table. Now, that's a great idea. Now think about what it requires. The food, you don't wrap all those gifts at 3 o'clock, and the food needs to be at the right temperature and the right. So it means you need to be wrapping presents throughout the entire night, which means you need like 3 to 4 additional people the back.
Wow.
And it was destroying our service, like killing it. We couldn't keep up. The team was so frustrated.
That's amazing.
And so eventually I had to back off a little bit and half of the presents were wrapped and half of them were just in beautiful boxes with bows that you could just take the lid off. My point is, when you talk about ambition versus hospitality, sometimes your ambition gets the better of you and you need people on your team to say, we believe we can still accomplish what we're trying to accomplish without leaving so many bodies in our wake. And you need to be open to the fact that maybe exactly the way you saw things from the get-go may not actually be correct. And so that's where people would jump in, not in pursuit, not as it pertained to the goal itself, but as it pertained to the ways in which I was pursuing it.
I love it. You talked about this role called the Dream Weaver.
Yes.
How does one get approved to create that such role? Like, how did you just go, you know, I'm going to create a Dream Weaver and this guy's going to have full reign and we're going to empower this person? When did you realize that in the process too?
Well, so the hot dog story, which is very well documented at this point, which is where I kind of stumbled on this idea of improvisational hospitality, that if we could be open to creating experiences that were truly bespoke to every single person and be present with the tables, not take ourselves too seriously and find these one size fits one gestures, that would be where we were like finding our fully unreasonable rhythm as it pertained to hospitality. And so I had this big meeting with the team and I gave them the permission to just listen to the people they were serving and come up with whatever ideas they wanted and just make them happen. But I think a lot of leaders do this. They have a great idea, they give their team permission to do something amazing, and they don't back it up with the resources to make that idea actionable. The stuff we would do for people required going out into the city in a moment's notice. You overheard someone say something, you had to go run and grab it and do something and turn it around. And we just didn't have people sitting around in the back waiting to go run errands. Thankfully I owned the restaurant. So I didn't have to ask for permission.
You had to give yourself permission.
Yeah, I just had to give myself permission. And so I did. And that the addition of that position was a really big turning point. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to like be super granular about something. The Dreamweaver wasn't given full autonomy. The entire team was given autonomy. The Dreamweavers were just there to help everyone else in the team bring their ideas to life. And I say that because that's a very, very important distinction. And I've seen people read my book and try to implement this culture and mess it up for that exact reason. They hire one person and charge that person with being creative and give that person the empowerment of coming up with hospitable ideas. But that only accomplishes half of the point. You're giving the guest, you're giving your customers cool experiences now. But the biggest power of unreasonable hospitality is that on my restaurant, the servers, who are ultimately the people that make or break an experience, right? You can go to a restaurant and have like whatever food and great service, you'll go back. If you go to a restaurant and have good food and terrible service, you're never going back. It's every individual server that actually, the only other example of that I can figure out is like a SoulCycle class. If the instructor sucks, the class is terrible. The server sucks, the restaurant is terrible. When you create an environment where they're no longer just serving plates of food that someone else created, but rather they are imbuing the experience with their own creativity. When you give them that agency and that empowerment, they bring so much more of themselves to the table. And so I think that's just an important distinction because it's about empowering as many people on the team as possible, as opposed to just handing the keys of creativity and gifting and fun and awesomeness to an individual.
Well, you've moved past that phase in your life with 11 Madison Park, but you're still the flag bearer of unreasonable hospitality. Are you finding new ways of applying that principle in your life, in your family, and in the world as it is right now for you?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, okay, professionally. I will have another restaurant at some point. I don't know. I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't want to open a bunch of restaurants again. I had a huge company, and I don't need or want that again. But I love restaurants, and I will have another one. But if I'm only going to have one, I need to wait for it to find me. In the meantime, I mean, I'm spending so much time with so many people from across disciplines. And I feel like my calling now is to try to convince as many people in as many different businesses to make the choice to be in the hospitality industry, because I do genuinely believe that we're in a moment right now where whether, I mean, to get super grandiose, you look at the political landscape, you look at the post-pandemic world of hybrid remote work, you look at the digital transformation with AI, you look at how just with each passing generation there's an increased sense of loneliness. I believe hospitality is the answer to most of the problems we're facing. And if it's less global and more granular, I just genuinely do believe that it is the secret to creating more profitable businesses. And so I'm having a blast working with everything from tech to finance to nonprofits to lawn care companies to Olympic teams to NFL teams and everything in between, trying to convince them to make that choice to be in the hospitality industry. And I'm doing it through television, through I'm working on my next book and all this stuff. But in my life, I don't need to prove that I can run a restaurant. And to your point about like my worldview and me focusing on being in last place, this is definitely a part of my dysfunction or function, depending on what lens you want to look through it. I always do feel like there's, I need to always have something I'm trying to prove in order to drive me forward.
Right.
I no longer need to prove I can run an amazing restaurant. Then I said, okay, let me prove to myself that I can write a great book. And like that worked. There's things I still need to prove to myself professionally, or I believe there are. I haven't found them yet. the thing I know I need to prove to myself is that I could be a great dad. Mm-hmm. And relationships are relationships, and the lessons you learn from those in life can help you succeed at work. And similarly, those that you learn at work can help you succeed with the ones you have in your life. And I'm trying to figure out how to take all these things that help me succeed in business and use the ones that apply to make me succeed as a father.
That says it is one of the things I really loved in your story was how close you were to your family, or how close you are, your relationship with your dad. You know, Aaron was even mentioning earlier that one of the things that stood out to him was the impact of the loss of your mom. And
I was crying in the first chapter in a coffee shop in LA, going, and it felt, and it, you know, it was really, reading your book was really special to me. It felt like a great American novel.
Thank you,
man.
I
wasn't just reading a, you know, another inspirational book that I think is wonderful. We write, you know, you work on, we work on this all the time, but being able to get inside of the glimpse of someone's like heart and mind and like human experience was really unique.
Thank you
for that. Yeah,
I appreciate that.
Yeah. But your dad, you guys are so close. I hijacked your question.
Yeah,
please. But you guys are so incredibly close. How? And how have you kept that consistent?
Well, I want to answer that and use it as a segue to ask the two of you a question about your relationship.
Sure.
Because
my
dad and I are extraordinarily close. But I don't know. You talk about adversity being a terrible thing to waste. Mm. He and I were together 2 weeks ago. He lives in Sarasota now. I went down with the family, and the day after we got there, I was doing a talk in Orlando, and so my dad and I woke up early, and he drove with me to Orlando, and the whole point was then we'd have 2 hours, just the two of us in the car on the way there, 2 hours, the two of us on the way back. And knowing that we don't get that time as often as we'd like, we both went into the car ride with a bunch of intention. Like, we both had things we each wanted to talk about. And one of my questions was, or one of my conversation topics was, to try to unpack together what we had done such that we were so close, so that I could focus on doing those same things with my kids. And we struggled a little bit in that conversation. And I think it's because our lives were a bit hazy back then with my mom's sickness. Like, and I don't know in either direction whether we would be as close as we are if she hadn't been sick. But we were a team. I mean, we had to be close. And so that's actually 10 minutes into our conversation, the one we're having right now. I said, I want to make sure I ask them, because I look at the relationship you have. And what I think is so cool is there's clearly a beautiful father-son love and like appropriate reverence there. But there's also like a cool friendship that I feel. And you're also working together.
I do like Aaron.
You like each other and you love each other.
I think loving each other is easier than liking each other.
For sure. So what did... I always say athletes always go to the tapes and they've had a bad game to see what they did wrong to make sure they don't do it again. We don't all often enough go to the tapes and we've had a good game to see what we did right to make sure we keep on doing that thing. What did you do right?
You want to start there since you're the one who experienced it?
No, I mean, I think what he did right was being very open about all the things he did wrong. And so, and then I think the relational closeness comes from a continual pursuit of commonalities and each other's interests. I am not always interested in all of the facts. He is like a Snapple cap. I think he's the brain behind all of those caps. Every day there's a new fact, there's a new interview, there's a new thing, and I'm like, my man, I love you, but I want to talk about nothing today. I think you talked a bit about how you don't know if you would be close with as close to your dad if you hadn't gone through kind of what had happened to your mom early on. But I think the reality was that growing up, I always knew that the relationship mattered more than the business he was building, than the career he was building. And so, you know, he kind of slipped that little, like, you know, I don't know, Trump, there were that little red button in into my back pocket as a kid going, you know, you matter so much more than anything else I achieve. And so I think I, especially with him traveling 48 weeks a year, I really grew up with this sense of, I know he's going to build something and I'm on the team. I'm just the team at home.
Yeah.
And so I kind of always had this sense of belief that we were building something bigger than what either one of us could do individually. Yeah. That's my answer.
And he communicated that to you through words, actions, energy, or all of the above?
I think all of the above, but really the words of, if you ever really need me, I'll be here.
Like he would say that to you directly.
Yes, yeah. I'm one phone call away.
Literally, when cell phones came out, I bought Aaron a cell phone.
Yeah.
And I gave him my number and I said, anywhere I am in the world, if you need me, call me. And I remember the first time he called me, I'm in front of an audience of maybe 10,000 people and my phone rang in my pocket. And I said, I'm in the middle of my talk. and only at that time, you know, my family were only ones that had that number. And so I said, excuse me a minute. And I looked at my phone and said, it's my son.
Wait, how old was he then?
13, maybe 12.
12 years old, I think 12.
I was too early for a phone, but it was like the bat phone. It was don't bat phone. Use this, but call me if you need me.
You can't call anyone else.
Don't call anyone else.
He only had it for the phone call.
For you. Know? Yeah.
And I said, it's my son. And hold on a second. And I just said, Aaron, hey, buddy. And I started talking to him on stage.
I'm sure people loved that.
Oh, they loved it. And but it was also, I wanted to teach these high driving type A leaders that they can put their families first. And so I not only did it for Aaron because I always wanted Aaron to know, and he was testing me too. Is he going to answer the phone? And he's like, Dad, I just want to say hi. And I go, it's great. I'm talking, you know, like 10,000 people right now. Can you say hi? You know, everybody like here. Yeah. And it was one of those moments. And when I would travel the world, I also took him with me a lot. And first only him because Mariah was the first, was afraid to fly.
Yeah.
So I would alternate trips and she would choose not to go. So he got to go everywhere around the world. Went to over 30 countries by the time he was 15, 14 years old.
Yeah, really young.
And ended up happening the same way for Mariah too, when she realized she was missing out on traveling the world.
Yes.
And so I would travel and people would always have an extra chair because they always knew that Aaron or Mariah would be there. And so it didn't matter if it was a business meeting, it didn't matter if it was a leadership meeting, they just knew that I would have one of my kids with me.
So cool.
And when I didn't have them, there would always be an empty chair there because they just were told ahead of time that I would.
So then there was always something to remind you that you didn't have one of your kids. Well,
no, because they assumed they were coming.
And
we would show up.
So I think there's several things. I think a lot of husbands and fathers travel as a way to get away from their wives and their kids. I didn't. And I wanted them with me. And so I just made a decision that they were going to see the world with me. I don't know what grade Aaron was in when I took you to Tokyo. You were 9 or 10 years old?
No, I was like six.
Six or seven.
Seven.
So I go to school and I tell Aaron, you're going to Tokyo with me.
I was pissed.
And he was angry because
mad.
He wanted to have perfect attendance.
Yeah.
In school.
they had said, like, you know, if you get through kindergarten to eighth grade,
the 12th
grade, then you get this like award.
And he told me, he goes, Dad, I'm gonna graduate with perfect attendance in 12th grade. I'm like, what first grader is thinking about graduating with perfect attendance? And I remember looking at him and said, buddy, you are never going to have perfect attendance.
As my son, that you lost that before you even got before you were even born, you had lost that.
But you know, he's in elementary school. Yeah. We go to the library, and I remember on the way to Tokyo, we picked up Catcher in the Rye. Yeah. I didn't know it was a high school book. You know, it was a book that impacted me as a kid. And so I said, I want you to read this book as we're going flying to Tokyo. And then while we're in Japan, we studied Japanese culture and populations, religion. I took him to the Shinto temple and we talked about Shintoism. And so I would use those experiences to broaden his own knowledge of the world and understanding cultures. And it really messed him up for school because he'd be so bored in school learning about things in books that he had already experienced around the world was a challenge for him. But a part of it for me for parenting was I didn't consider anything in my life of higher value than being married to Kim and having Aaron and Mariah, you know, as my kids. And anything that opened up to me in the world, I considered it a gift given to me that I was supposed to share with my children.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a nuanced thing. I think a lot of parents want their kids to be interested in their lives rather than being interested in their kids' lives. And I just wanted to be interested in what Aaron or Mariah were interested in. And then I just created opportunities. Like I bought every instrument in the world and put them in the house.
I'm gonna call you on the last one.
Go ahead.
Because almost every field trip I ever had, if it was him, if he was the parent that was allocated to go with me on the field trip, it was, I knew we were gonna be there for about an hour. And then we were going to some boardroom that he had to go and consult with. I, growing up was like in like ABC, Disney, all these different places. And we'd go to the zoo and I was like, I actually really want to go here. And he's like, I'm sorry, like we're going for an hour. And you're gonna run down the street to Disney and you're going to sit in a boardroom for the next 5 hours. And I would sit there and he would. And you go, you have an option. You can sit in the room or you can go outside. But, you know, I'm going to do this. And like, I'd rather you do this than the zoo. And I'm like, but I'd rather do this. You know, so we always had a push and a pull.
Yeah.
I just learned early, like I get to hang out with my dad.
Yeah.
A lot of these other guys don't get to do that. And then, that's just like a big win.
We'd be in a strategic meeting with all these leaders and CEOs. And afterwards, you'd say, can I tell you what I saw? And so I would let him walk through a description of every single person in the room, his evaluation of their leadership ability, of whether they would actually execute the strategies, of who was all talk, who would actually be action. And he was so accurate. And that I don't know. I think I would just talk to Aaron like he was an adult.
Well, yeah, it's like how kids can learn languages more easily than adults. You probably
I love that. Yeah, so
anyway, we don't have much time.
Yeah, we don't have much time.
Gotta get him out of here.
Yeah.
So.
No, but I love that. That was really meaningful for me. I love that.
Aaron and Mariah both live within 10 minutes of me and Kim.
Now.
They have their homes within.
You did New York, she did Franklin. You both moved home.
Both moved back, yeah.
And I love the fact that our kids are such good friends that they choose to live close to us.
Yeah.
And we see them almost every single day. And, you know, Mariah is a person who really is a deeply spiritual person, loves the church, loves worship, and she works with me in Mosaic. And Aaron is a guy who really has a drive for the business world and to make an impact in this space. And so we do the arena and other things together. And it's just really, for me, wonderful that I get to do life with my kids who are now adults who could choose to live anywhere in the world.
And do anything.
And see me once a year at Christmas, you know. And instead, we do life together. And I think that's the greatest reward of parenting is when your kids grow up and they choose to be your friend.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Hey, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Dude, this was, it was like a masterclass in family at the end there.
I loved it. And thank you.
We're just so excited to have you. And it's just an honor. Well, we're so, inspired by your life, inspired by not just what you were able to accomplish through 11 Madison Park, but also the human being you are.
Oh, man.
You know, the essence of who you are as a person. And when I met you, I rarely meet someone and think, oh, I cannot believe I'm getting to meet this person. But I have to say, when I first met you, that's the feeling I had, was I get to meet someone who's accomplished something really unique in the world. And then when I got to just spend a few minutes knowing you, I thought, what a beautiful human being.
Oh, dude.
I think that's the rare thing in life. You know, I get to travel the world and, you know, as you do, and meet so many interesting people. And when you meet someone who just carries an essence of kindness and grace, of genius and humility, it's just the greatest gift in the world. And that's who you are. And I want to thank you for being the human being that you are, because the world needs more people like you.
Absolutely.
I think life is, I tell people that like moving through life is like walking through Times Square in the wrong direction. and there's literally like just hundreds and then thousands of people just kind of passing by you, and every once in a while someone walks by you and you literally want to like just grab onto their body, their arm, whatever, and just try to hold on to them. And those are the relationships that you ultimately want to pursue. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to pursue relationships with both of you, sincerely.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you. I apologize for all the noise, but I just feel like it makes this interview more authentically New York.
I feel very at home.
And I can't wait till we have another conversation. And I heard a secret that you leaked out, that you're writing another book.
I'm working on it,
Well, we'll have to come back.
Will you come back and talk to us about your next book when you...
I would love it. When the time is right, I would love that.
All right, that's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Hey guys, thank you for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Will. But before we go, we have a few requests. Check out our YouTube channel and hit subscribe. Do that now. And if you haven't checked out our Instagram, it's at MindShiftPod. Really simple, really easy. We play inspirational clips that my dad and I and our guests speak out into existence. But if you haven't checked that out, do it now. Follow us there. You are also listening to us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Google, on Amazon, all the different podcast platforms. We just want to thank you. Take the time, if I can ask, and be so bold to rate and review this podcast and share it with a friend. I think that third one is the thing I always forget to do, but we would not have this community or this family of MindShift podcasters if it wasn't for you. And we want to grow this family, we want to continue to build it. So go check this out, and then also share this podcast with your friends.